Welcome to the Danny Palmer Show. Does it sound cool if I say it like that? Welcome to the vainly titled Danny Palmer Show. We're back again. I'm super stoked this week. My guest and I used to work together back in the fucking Dizzy down in ATL, Georgia. Whatever I do for ya. Whatever I do for ya. I don't even know how to describe your career at this point. We'll walk through it and your life. He went to Arizona. He's a successful businessman in the world of recruiting and HR. And he's a funny motherfucker and a cool guy. Jared King, how you doing, pal?
I'm doing well, man. It's a pleasure to be a part. Just saw that you hit the 200 episode and made sure I sent you a text to just say congratulations and proud of you for sticking with it, man. You are nothing if not untalented and consistent.
I have a cold. I can't laugh too much, I guess.
Dude. Oh, sorry.
Hilarious. No, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Untalented and consistent is all I'm going for in life.
Yeah. A C average. There's nothing wrong with a C average. That's where everybody falls in the bell curve. I don't know why everybody's like negative about the C average. Like, why can't we all be average?
Yeah, except I was like basically straight A's, but I'm sure you were just middling by with D's. Were you going to be attacked by the host?
No. I have a degree. I mean, that's all that matters. I still wake up with that that horrible dream where I have one class left and I still have to like finish up. But I have that at least once a month.
Dude, I have a dream where I'm back in high school and I can't find my locker and I just keep going to the classes that aren't my class. And I'm like currently I'm like in my 40s and no one seems to notice that or care, but I'm just like way behind.
I don't know.
It's weird, right? I know it's a common dream, but it's just a weird thing. Like, why am I back in high school?
Yeah. No. I definitely understand. So I do have a question.
Fire away.
Super interested. Like, who are your comedy influences? Like that was one of those things that like I never really asked you. You've been doing this what, 9 years, right?
12
years?
I mean, maybe 11 if you take away the pandemic, but 11 to 12.
So it was 12 years ago when you did the punchline?
Well, that was class. That was in like 2006. But I didn't really start taking comedy seriously until 2009. And then if you take away a year off the pandemic, that's 11, right? Yeah. So it's like 11 to 12. I didn't do shit. I did that punchline show. I took this class in Atlanta. I did the punchline graduation show. Went amazing. Then the next show, I completely tanked. And then I was too afraid to go to open mics by myself for 2 years. Then I abandoned Jared and our whole crew down in Atlanta, moved to New York, took a year-long comedy program, and then started doing it. So since then, it's been like 11 years.
So it's been 11 years. Okay.
Yeah.
And so did you intentionally like take off everything before 2007 on LinkedIn? Like, it's like you try to make yourself younger?
I don't even know. I think that I got like an outplacement service when I got laid off from Sapient for the second time. And they just redid the whole thing.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, so comedy influences, like let's not get too far off track because I'm definitely interested in some of these things. Like just what drives you all these years, like having gone to New York, like and being there, like when the comedy dream happened. Like I was literally like in that room with you in a bullpen, like watching this happen.
Oh, that's right. You came to that first show, right? At the punchline?
I don't know if I've ever seen you. No.
In that bullpen. Oh, you mean when we worked together at Sapient in the early 2000s?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
I mean, I was a late bloomer, quote unquote, because I mean, nobody in my family or like friend circle really had any ties to entertainment or show business. So I mean, I would just like, you know, watch typical like Chris Rock. I think Bigger and Blacker, Bring the Pain and Bigger and Blacker were probably the two specials that made me like be like, oh, maybe this is something I should try. Cause I just remember being, I had a townhouse in Atlanta and I would sit there late at night after people left or whatever. And I would be high. And I watched, I don't know if it was Bring the Pain or Bigger and Blacker, it's one of those two. And I just remember like listening, not just to the jokes, but to the laughter. It just like, it was like the surrounding envelope of like warmth and love and just beautiful. It's just beautiful to hear the like deep resounding laughs. And I was like, man, that must be insane to get that level of laughs in a theater. That sounds like tempting, you know? And then me and my girlfriend would sit around. I would always like be trying to think of jokes and busting balls, you know, like we do when we're out drinking. And then we started writing down joke ideas in her apartment. And then I was like, maybe I should try it. And so I was like, maybe I'll just try a comedy course. So I think it was just really those two Chris Rock specials. I mean, I didn't, I wasn't like a comedy aficionado by any means, but you know, I've seen like, I guess like Comedy Central specials and like Wet Hot American Summer. I don't know, like watching Seinfeld, like I guess all the traditional like lame ass influences that everybody has, but I never like took it upon myself like, oh, maybe I could do this until Chris Rock kind of spurred me to try.
Huh. Okay. And so like, I guess, so what's changed over the last like decade? I mean, in terms of influences, like, is it more like localized, like people that I never maybe have heard of just because I don't know enough about comedy, or are there like, is it a Tell Ross, different people like in the scene, like what kind of like comedy, like I guess influences you now?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think a big part of my journey, just like it being in the world of comedy, is at first in Atlanta, I was like, I would watch these Comedy Central specials and be like, these guys suck. I'm way better than that. And then I moved to New York and then I just started bombing. And then I started being around like thousands of other comics that were way better than me, that had been doing it longer, that were performing every single night. And I realized that I was swimming in this giant sea of much more talented comics. And that was like really eye-opening for me. And then I just started spending more time like sitting in the back of the room, watching other comics perform, trying to like learn from them. Like, so yeah, I mean, I would say broadly speaking, like some of the larger New York comics, like Julian McCullough, Adrian Iapolucci, Sarah Tolomash, Ricky Velez, my friend, you know, Monroe Martin, Derek Gaines. I'm trying to think, man, there's just so many, you know, like I would go to the Cellar and see some of those big names like Artie Fuqua and Keith Robinson. And I just got exposed to like so many good comics that it's hard to put my finger and say these two or three really influenced my style, but just more like just diving into the ocean of these are much better comics than you and starting to try to, you know, breathe in some of their air. I think that's what helped me. Like, dude, I don't know why this always stands out in my mind, but I think of this one show I saw Julian McCullough and
Hold on. Are you getting any feedback?
No. Are you?
Feedback? It seems like feedback. You might be cutting out a little bit. I just want to make sure there's no issues on your side. Is it clean on your side in terms of like internet?
Yeah, I think so. No, I'm glad you said that.
So like, but everything, can you see to make sure like everything's coming through clean? I'd hate to do like all this and be like, oh, it didn't work.
No, that's fine. You can do that for a second. Let's see.
We can cut right back in.
I'm testing the mic. Can you hear that?
Yep. Everything's clean. It's just over the last couple of minutes, like there's been, it's almost like it's a old school Wi-Fi. Like, hey, like, is he kind of going in and out?
Yeah, I think it's okay. I honestly don't have the ability to troubleshoot it.
Okay. Cut it back on then. You're good.
This is the most rinky dink podcast, but hey, over time, who knows?
I don't care. That's fine. I don't care.
Yeah. So I was just going to say that. So Julian McCullough, I saw him before he moved to LA. He did a show at Eastville Comedy Club in the East Village here near where I live now. And something had happened in the room. Like he was probably the fifth or sixth comic. And something had happened in the room where somebody had like a weird hat on or something. And the MC and the first comic, like both addressed the weird hat. And he wasn't there. I sat through the whole show. But he wasn't there for the whole show because he was a real comic and had spots to do. He was jumping around. He just showed up like right before his set, basically. Goes on stage, makes a comment about the weird hat, and it just completely bombs because everybody's already, we already know the weird hat. Like it just, but he wasn't there. He didn't know that. So then he goes, good start. And then 3 to 4 minutes later, the crowd was laughing so hard that he had to pull the microphone away from him to just give the audience a minute to finish their laughter. Because they were dying laughing so fucking hard. And I was like, Danny, you have no skills. That is skill. So seeing things like that just showed me the, you know, giant mountain ahead that I had to climb if I wanted to get to be any good. So stuff like that has been always been really influential. Moments like that, you know, like just moments of enforced humility based on the reality of who's actually good and who's the fucking rookie that just showed up, me, you know?
Sure. I mean, I think... I think it's a pretty underappreciated craft in terms of the ability to be an individual and live and die with you as the product, right? Like you're not selling anything other than your voice standing in front of someone. Like you could do your face, like you could pull out the carrot top props, or you could wear a funny outfit, or You could chain your fucking wallet to yourself like Big J or whatever it is, right? Like you could have a little like thing, but like 1 second later, I think I've heard Seinfeld say some bullshit. Like even after 5 minutes, like Jerry Seinfeld, like the whole thing wears off. It's like, hey, like you're like, we're here to laugh. Like that's great. Like you're whoever you are, but like you better make me fucking laugh.
Yeah. You can't fake laughter. I mean, you can maybe for like one joke or something, but you can't fake laughter over the course of a 15-minute set. Like if it's funny, it's funny. If it's not, it's not. Like there's no way around it. Even if it's your friend. Sometimes I would get offended in the early going because I would do like bringer shows or I would bring my friends. And then some of those I would tank and I'm like, wait, you guys are my friends. Why aren't you laughing at this? And it's like, it doesn't matter that we're your friends. That's not funny.
I think you appreciate that more. Lesson. Like, yeah, I think you appreciate that more. I think that like resonates more like as you get to know why they're laughing at you or not laughing at you, right? Like I think it's more important to have that genuine feedback and be like, all right, like if they're faking it, like I'm definitely not getting better, right? I mean, it's incremental like percentages of getting better when it comes to comedy, right? Like I think I've talked to you and you've been doing shit multiple spots a week, 4, 5, 6, 7 nights a week for a decade. And you know, like if you didn't love this for yourself, I don't know where this would be, I guess, in terms of a journey.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they always say, but it is 100% true. Like if you do stand up to get rich and famous, like it might work out, but the odds are super against it ever working out. Like you have to do it because you love it. Like that's the only way that you're going to have the dedication and commitment that it takes to work over the course of a lifetime, because that's what it's what it takes. Like, there's no guarantee that even if you're good, that you're going to get anywhere over 15 years. So if you don't like doing this, get the fuck out. Like, you can't depend on the industry to validate your efforts. You have to depend on loving the craft to justify your efforts, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and I think as somebody who is a lifelong comedy fan, as I am, you definitely know who's forced upon us. Because they flame hard, but they definitely do not necessarily have that staying power. Like, and I'm not trying to call anybody out, but like, it is obvious when the industry just decides like, hey, like we're rolling with this person until like, you know, the Pizza Hut commercial's over. Right. I mean, like,
yeah.
And I gotta be honest, like grab every dollar in this world that you can, because who cares?
Sure.
If yeah, you're like, I don't have any issue with it. I'm not trying to, that's what I'm saying. I'm not like trying to badmouth anybody, but like there is an interesting time where I'm like, is that funny? Like, are we sure that's funny? Because like I don't think I've laughed, and I'm a pretty good gauge of like what's funny, I think.
Yeah, there's really no skipping the line. I mean there's exceptions to every rule, but there's really no skipping the line when it comes to stand-up. Like you can't, just because you're 2 or 3 years in and you got some heat behind you doesn't mean that you're gonna smash after following like Will Silvins or Greer Barnes. Greer Barnes is a good example of an influence. Like, nobody can touch Greer Barnes. So you can have all the heat on you 2 years in, but you're still not going to crush in the way that Greer Barnes crushes. And then, yeah, maybe the industry will push you, but that isn't going to float your boat forever. At some point, you got to kill in front of random ass people across the country.
Yeah, for sure. Or build enough, like in that, what is that? That 10,000 people following. What is that rule? Is that like one of those Malcolm Gladwell things? Where you get 10,000 people to like you and like you can have a following anywhere in the world. Like whether you're like, you just need like 10,000 people to like you across the country. And then like you have enough to like go at least be a middler. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, like 10,000 people across the country or 10,000 people in each major city where you can.
No, across the country, like have 10,000 fans. Yeah. I might be like if you have 10,000 people that are like, hey, I know Danny Palmer, like you could probably sell out your comedy show in 7 to 8 cities, I'm guessing, if you have 10,000 fans and you target like where they are in the country. And I'm thinking way too meta. I'm sorry.
No, but that's a good point. It's just like, how do you figure out where they are? Yeah, I think most of my quote unquote, I don't know that I have like fans per se, but most people that have seen me perform stand up have seen me perform in New York, either live here or visited for a week. That's why I like this podcast, because the podcast builds a loyal audience over time. The stand up's like, hey, we assembled in this room. That was fun. And then I never saw them again. There's no connection to it over the long term.
And you, I mean, and so like, I guess what, so I guess I was definitely surprised that, so Chris Rock is comedy influence and everybody that you named in terms of comedian is definitely more localized than from a national perspective, like, because I don't go to comedy shows like at all, right? Like, I live in the burbs. Like, I haven't been on the punchline since I probably saw Janine Garofalo, and she was not even like somebody big, right? Like, so, I know Richard Pryor did a lot of cocaine there and stuff. Like, so, I mean, that place seems awesome, right? Like,
he did blow at the Atlanta punchline. I didn't know that.
Richard Pryor, I think, was a pretty, he was a regular at the punchline in Atlanta, that exact place. Yeah.
The old punchline on Hildebrand?
Yeah.
That's cool to know.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I told you I'm a little bit of a comedy nerd.
I love it. What made you become a comedy nerd?
My parents, they introduced me to comedy, the very first HBO comedian special, 1975, Robert Klein.
You were allowed to watch that as a kid?
Yeah, my parents made horrible choices, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think dirty, right? What?
Say again?
Robert Klein's not like a dirty comic, is he?
He was the first guy to actually curse on a special. Like, that was the big thing. Like, no one had ever cursed on TV, quote unquote. And HBO had his first special and he cursed and said shit, I think.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So they showed you that special and you're like, wow, this is quite an art form. I want to keep following it.
Yeah. I mean, 1983 was a huge year, right? Like, so 83 is Eddie Murphy, Delirious, and Carlin at Carnegie. And at 12 years old, like, that blew my mind, right? Like, my parents were like, we're going to sit down and you guys are going to watch Carlin at Carnegie, which means my brother was 7, maybe, when he saw the 7 dirty words you can't say on television, which is the last time I believe Carlin ever performed that live. I don't know if that's going way too inside baseball on you.
No, that's interesting. So was 83 like a big year for stand-up because of those two specials?
Yeah, Eddie Murphy Delirious was huge, and everything had already kind of blown up because Dangerfields had Bill Hicks, he had Saget, he had Roseanne Barr was like his like wife in a little sketch. Like, she was kind of like, you know, Dangerfields. I don't know if you remember, like, young comedians. Like, there was like, I guess before, like, Just for Laughs, all that, like, stuff, like, this was the only way you really, like, kind of got big. You got on that HBO show. So, like, anybody you think of from the 80s was, like, all on that stuff. Like, I saw Kinison was the very first time Kinison, Dice, very first time Dice committed to that character and never broke again.
There was a show on HBO called Dangerfields?
Yeah. Dangerfields Comedy, I think it was called.
Oh,
it was like once a year he put it on. It was in his comedy store and he hosted a night of young comedians that he identified, which I don't know if they were really young comedians. They were like up and comers, but every one of them is a knockout. Yeah.
That's badass. So you saw that on HBO and you're like, holy shit, this is the cream of the crop brought to me on HBO when this is somewhat of a burgeoning art form. That's pretty cool. Yeah. You got to see that then, right?
Yeah. So I've seen every special, like, back in the day. Like, I mean, you could just name any legendary comic and I've seen the majority of what they've done.
So you saw them right at the outset. So your first time seeing Sam Kinison wasn't later when he blew up, but like,
no, it was literally the very first time and I lost my shit. I was like, oh my god, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. Like, there was no question about it. I could still do the entire thing. Like, I could break out and do the entire set and it'll be funnier than anything you've ever seen.
Is that the does he do the one about the move to where the food is joke?
Oh, yeah. The people in Africa, right? You move to where the food is, right? You see what this is? This is sand. You know what's going to be in a million years? It could be fucking sand. Move to where the food is. That's why we don't live there. I mean, the whole thing is just groundbreaking. I mean, the guy's amazing.
So that's nice. How old were you when you were watching that stuff?
It started early. Like, I mean, it's hard to explain. Like, I grew up I think the whole, a lot of like Jersey, Philly, New York guys, right? Like, busting balls is a way of life, like, when you grow up in that area. So it's hard to explain, right? So everybody's telling a joke. Everybody's trying to get the spotlight on them when it's all guys hanging out, right? Like, it's just mass testosterone. There's no females, like, right? We're talking about getting laid. We're never getting laid, right? Like,
right.
right? Like, I mean, we're just talking about like how cool our life would be if we did certain things. We will never do any of those things.
So that's cool. See, I think I was, my parents are very conservative and shielded me from a lot of that, you know, adult R-rated content. Yours were not. And then that allowed you to see the beginning of a pretty, not the beginning, but the early stages of a fucking dope ass art form, probably influenced your, I don't know, decisions, your psyche, your development as a teenager, I would think, right? It had to.
It's just, I think it's part of the pop culture, right? Like, I think it's just kind of everything that comes at you, just how it shapes you. I think the thing about comedy is how much truth there is in the greater, not greater, the more legendary comedians, right? Like that honed their craft for thousands of hours. And like when they got to that special, like they were essentially like pouring out everything they had, right? Like they didn't know if they were ever getting another chance to be in front of millions of people. Like this is the largest audience you're ever going to see, like bar none. I don't care if it's on Showtime, Cinemax, whatever, like HBO, like wherever, like, or what was that show? Star Search. Like whatever it was, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like it was going to be the largest audience you ever had. So like people were pouring out every joke that they had that was just the greatest. And so like when you're watching it, you're not just watching somebody who's trying to come up with a new hour every year and all that stuff, which I totally understand is the evolution of the art form. Like I have no issue with that as like a comedy, like, you know, nerd. Because I think it's harder to make me laugh. Like I go back and I listen to old stuff and some stuff holds up and some stuff definitely does not hold up.
Yeah. That's a good point though. That was like the culmination of everything they'd created and they didn't know if they would have what their future would be beyond that moment. That was like the moment for them and the audience, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I thought of it like that. Yeah, specials today aren't like that because there's so much more of a large volume body of work that's readily available and it's much more, you know, ingrained part of the culture. There's a whole library, a trove of stand-up specials now, but there wasn't then.
No, I mean, if I think I mean the first record I ever heard, comedy record, I don't know if you've ever even heard this heard of this guy. His name is Freddie Prinze.
Yeah, we've talked about him before. You love Freddie Prinze.
Yeah, I love Freddie Prinze.
Didn't he die at like 27 or something, but he was like a legend?
He was 22.
22, Jesus. Yeah. And he was great at stand-up before he was 22?
Yeah, he was amazing.
God damn it. It's like my Dua Lipa joke. I hate when people are much younger than me and much more talented. It's like, fuck you.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I want that.
Yeah. How's that working out?
It's not.
Okay.
I'm listening to a lot of Dua Lipa, though.
I know you are. I actually, like, I was, I mean, I don't know how many people listen to this, so I'll feel like an idiot right now. I was like, is it a legit bit to ask Danny, like, is there a difference between, like, not even a difference, like, is it a legitimate thought on my side that, like, you could have a full-on conversation about pop culture, like just bubblegum, like, pop music with a 14-year-old girl, like, and it would be a pretty, like, she'd be like, all right, he's not crazy. I mean, he's bald and old, but like he at least knew what he was talking about, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm an authentic fan. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to like be cool and fit in. Like, I love her.
Yeah.
I love her music.
I figured.
Yeah. That's funny. Me and some 14-year-old girl are just like obsessing over Dua Lipa. You're like, Danny, you should not be talking to her. Like, hey man, this is strictly professional. Yeah.
Danny, I just want to tell you, like, that TikTok, you got to log out and then log back in so we don't see, like, you know.
What were you going to say about Freddie Prinze?
No, I mean, he had this record called Looking Good. And it was, like, I mean, just to this day, like, it's 28 minutes, two sides, vinyl. My grandfather got it out of an incinerator in his building and gave it to me. Like, my grandfather, super cool guy. Like, he was a blue collar. He worked the printing press in New York for Mad Magazine at one point.
Huh. That sounds like a cool job. Maybe. I don't know.
It's
not like he's reading printing it.
I mean, I stopped reading it.
Just zooming by.
Capture,
read the captions. God damn it. It's going too fast.
What, so like now that you're, you know, all these years in, like, I still want to go back to you because I am super fascinated by like this journey of yours. Like, I don't know if you realize it. Like I look back, like it took me a good 3 minutes to scroll through the thread or text thread. It started in June 28th of 2016. So like
me and you,
I didn't look at it yet for you and I. So like, I definitely have some interesting, like you have some interesting thoughts for sure.
Why would our text thread only start in 2016? I've known you since like literally the year 2001.
Well, I don't think the text thread carried over from phone to phone.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Like, I don't think like that text thread, like, so it's everything, which, and I just like my daughter walked by and she was like, why are you like, why is your finger moving? So like, are you playing a game or something? And I was like, no. I'm like, I'm just looking at this text thread. I was just wondering like, when did it actually start? Like, I didn't read almost anything of it, but I was just like, when? And then she was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm just trying to get to the top, man. Like, I'm sure there's an easier way, but I'm old and I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that either. I would love to know that.
Yeah. But I was like, wow. I was like, we have spoken a lot over the years about kind of where you are in comedy. And like, I'll ask you like weird questions. You're always busy. Like, I'm not sure you accomplish anything, but you're always busy, right?
I know,
like,
man. It's such a grind, dude.
I mean, you cram in a lot. I know you do. Like, you're a fucking consistent motherfucker, like, in terms of, like,
thank you.
Whether it's your, you know, working out, you know, working, you're like, you're a structured dude. Like, you're always super structured, like, and I was not, so.
Right. I know. My friends make fun of me about that constantly. But also, yeah, like, if I was making money on comedy, I would be far less structured, because then I could just, like, own my day. But I can't, you know, I got a, like, hard corporate job. With hiring managers breathing down my neck literally every day. I don't want to get out of shape. I don't want to miss shows. Like, how else would I do it? Like, if I'm not structured, I'm going to fail in one of those three dimensions, you know?
For sure. No. For sure. No, I think it's amazing that you're able to do it.
To defensive mode. Yeah. No, thank you.
No. You shouldn't be defensive at all. You definitely shouldn't be defensive. I mean, you know, all that hard work and like the lack of success, why would you be like defensive, right?
I know. I've been thinking about that. I'm like, what is this actually? Oh, worth it? Dude. Like, no, but I think that
is this worth it?
Is this all worth it,
guys?
Like, especially when the pandemic
is this worth it?
Is this good? Like, when the pandemic like shut down everything for everybody. I mean, it was just like, okay, now what? And now like the wheels are churning again in the comedy world, but it's different. It's definitely different. And it's like, does all that, you know, sweat labor for 12 years matter anymore after the pandemic? Like, yeah, it does. But here's
my question. Like, and this is something I'd love to hear, like, the answer to, if you have an answer to this. But like, short term, like, what are your comedy quote unquote goals? Like, is it specific to like stage, or is it like production of some type of content, or like, what would feel like satisfaction and success, and like, what does that even look like?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like this podcast is like my number one asset in the comedy world. I mean, I guess the relationships that I have with some of the clubs and some of the producers and bookers is as, or if not more important, but the clubs, each individual club is a business selling tickets to sell drinks and to, you know, I mean, they're helping advance the art form, but they're a business in and of themselves. They don't care about Danny Palmer Inc. Whereas the podcast is like me. And I have like, it's a smaller podcast, but whatever, it is growing. Like, so I have listeners all over the world and I have markets and the country. So I think that is going to be my primary tool to build out a loyal audience over time. But then in terms of, to answer your question about the specifics, like, I don't really know. Like, I would love to be like touring theaters. I think that like doing a Brian Regan type of career where you tour theaters, that sounds amazing. But I think that's going to take some time to develop and evolve. And so, I mean, until I don't have the shackles, quote unquote, of a day job, it's going to be tough for me to like get out on the road and like, I don't know, man. I think it's gonna be a combination of my podcast growing, continuing to grind in New York, and my friends having success and maybe throwing a little bone to me here and there. I think though that combination of those three things, I think over time will yield some sort of results beyond what I have right now. That's my hope, anyways. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you, but I'm just going to keep going. And just, I try to just focus on like performing stand-up because I love stand-up. like my Black Hat show, I don't make any money off that. I go in this basement, this dingy basement. I carry these lights upstairs. I tell people to move. I like move a couch around. I receive $0 for that. I pay $150 a week because I buy people drinks. I buy comics drinks. Like it's like truly a labor of love. And so I don't want to lose that mindset or attitude, you know, even though I'm like not like a successful quote unquote comic. Like I feel like I have the respect of some of my peers in New York. And I think the other asset that I think that I have in New York is that I know these comics that are good over time. Like I've known Derek Gaines for 10 years and Ricky Velez for 10 years and Julio Gallerati, my close friend, he does the Oops, the podcast, a not like 2 to 3 year old podcast. Him and Francis Ellis, his co-host, they sold out 2 shows at City Winery tomorrow night in 1 hour. And Julio and I started at an open mic and at New York Comedy Club 10 years ago. So that kind of success for my friends, I think points to the fact that all of our rocket ships are hopefully headed up higher in some way or another over the course of the next 5 to 7 years. I don't know specifically how that's going to develop, but I'm optimistic that it will.
Okay. All right. No. That's fair. That's definitely fair. So, I mean, yeah, like, so, and you put in the time and I guess that Black Cat show, I mean, obviously I don't even think I've stepped into Manhattan since you've been there. Like, I think it's been that long.
Really?
Since I've been back. Yeah. My parents left the Jersey area and came down south. So I just didn't have family up there necessarily to like get up there. But I know that Black Cat thing, that Black Cat show is important and a labor of love. And I've seen like you pour a lot into it in terms of you're clearly trying to promote other people and everything like that. And I think, you know, the part that I find interesting, I guess is being a host is a super interesting, position that most people outside of the comedy world probably don't necessarily appreciate in terms of that's generally either A, somebody who is just starting. No, not starting. Sorry. So somebody that isn't as maybe advanced in their career or maybe has kind of maybe plateaued at a certain point. But a lot of times, like, that's where like that can be the person that is got the production value that like gets everybody there, pulls it all together, makes sure that it's in rhythm and that the third person's going after the fifth person, the fourth, whatever. So like, you know, who kills, you know, how it flows, you know, who like crushes after like whatever, like that whole experience, I think is a very, like, I mean, I just think it's a non thought for people outside the comedy world in some respects, right? Like just that, like, I do think that like doing that, like you've learned at least from the way I've kind of seen like things, evolve, especially in the podcast, just going from somebody that is able to not necessarily be the shining star, but shepherd everybody along and make sure that the experience is amazing for everybody. And that's maybe where the labor of love ends up giving you that intrinsic value, not to use a stupid word, but at the end of the night of being like, I really pulled this off.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, that's so perfectly stated. I love it. I love crafting a show that's hopefully good and like knowing those people and being friends with them, and I can like text A-list comics and be like, hey, can you do this date? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, great, see you there. That, and then I introduce them and they kill and they're my friend and I shake their hand, I buy them a drink and we catch up. Like, that's valuable, you know. It's nice.
Well, I think it's an under right appreciated service in terms of like how hard comics work when they have to work out like just a bit, right? Like some comics I think are just maybe running through their bits. Some comics are trying to get the time in. Some are like, I may not be able to sleep tonight if I don't work this out. Right. Like, so, and you providing like a venue for them to like work and maybe it's not the 100-person theater or whatever it is. It's just a room, but they know that when they come to that room, like there's going to be an expectation of like, I'm going to do a spot and there's going to be an audience there and Dan is going to take care of me. And like, it's not gonna be a bad, like if I'm doing 4 spots tonight, like that's not gonna be the one I'm worried about. Like that's not gonna be the one some jerks me around.
Yeah, that's thanks. That's high praise, and that's what I want. Like, yeah, like, I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's a free coffee shop show. Like, it's not that big of a fucking deal in the grand scheme of things, but it also is kind of a big deal because there's just like the emotional connection to it. And we have created, me and Ryan DeCarlos, my co-producer, we have created a great show over time, and I'm very proud of it. And I think it, like, there were like two weeks ago, I think, or 3 weeks ago. You know, I try to make it like I convert it from a coffee shop into being a comedy club, basically. And I like turn the lights down, I blare music, and then after the show, I'm like, thanks for coming. And then I immediately like blare like Levitating by Dua Lipa or some like banger, like 99 Problems by Jay-Z. So it's like a good vibe. And then I did that a few weeks ago, and for some reason my comic friends had left, so it was just me. And then the people were filing out of the room, and like to a person, they were like, thanks, man, that was great. Thanks, man, that was great. And I was like, just that little affirmation was like, I don't know. It just meant a lot to me.
No, for sure.
Even though I'm not getting any money, and even though the industry didn't see that, like, that was still valuable.
But I think the industry is such a like broad term, right? Like, I know. What the industry is like what you think of it is, right? Like, the industry is your friends in some respects. Like, they're absolutely, I mean, you're talking about your friends. Like, you just mentioned somebody like selling things out in an hour. Like, that's the industry still. Like, whether like they listen, like, if you're alive, you're part of the game, right? Like, it is what it is.
Yeah. If you're alive, you're part of the game.
I mean, you may not be wanting to play, but like, it's just like, hunting's my favorite sport. It's the only sport where the competitor doesn't know he's playing.
Right. Also, I think like over time, I think there's like, you know, that phrase, like if you hang around the barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. Like, if I said that to my friend Zach McGovern, who used to co-host the Space podcast, he would just roll his eyes and be like, that's bullshit. It's not true. That's just some stupid phrase. That's trite cliche. It doesn't mean anything in the real world. But I kind of believe it. Like, I feel like if you're working hard and you're getting better and you're building relationships, a lot of people across the industry, quote unquote, like, sooner or later, things are going to go your way. Like that Jerry Seinfeld quote, like, get so good, they can't deny it. Like, if you're a killer and you're polite and kind and warm to people, how bad is your life going to be in comedy, even if you're not, you know, selling out theaters? Like, you can still have a really good life.
And I mean, like, and not to shit on Zach, but like, he's pretty young, right? So he's a fucking moron, right? Like, experience is what tells you, like, opportunity is when, like, you know, hard work meets, you know, some type of like opportunity in front of you, like, that gives you an experience where you're like, hey, you know, maybe they didn't call Danny first or second, but they called me third, and I'm going to step up and I'm going to bust through that door. And you just never know when that's going to happen. And I think the older you get, the more times that you've experienced that deja vu feeling. And it's like, no, you're just like, I mean, you've lived a lot of days. Like, have you ever thought about like how many fucking days we've all lived? Like, do the math. It gets interesting.
Right. And you don't know like how people are going to help you and in what way. Like a classic example, like I got passed at Comic Ship Live. Pass means like you're allowed to perform in the pro shows. I got passed there like, oh wait, I'm sorry. I'm thinking about the stand. I got passed at the stand. And before I was passed at the stand, Pete brag. Lee. What?
That was a little bit of a humble brag.
I mean, I guess. Yeah, I guess so. But it's really, I mean, it's related to the, but
yeah, it is.
The reason
it
I'm
is.
Telling
just so you know,
this
no. It's just
because
so we're clear.
To explain.
Just so we're clear. I know you. I know you're a humble brag. Like, that's a fucking humble brag. Like, that, like, you shouldn't, no. But like,
it's context for the story.
I know, but I'm saying, like, you shouldn't undersell the fact that, like, 11 years ago, if I would have told you you were passed and I would have just thrown those places out equivalent if they were existing as the same, whatever, you'd be like, you're insane, Jared. Like,
that's true.
Like, don't undersell the fact that like you're passed at the Comic Strip Live. Like, that's a big deal.
Thanks.
I don't care if your friends don't think it's a big deal. I think it's a big deal.
Thank you. I mean, either of those clubs has given me a spot in over 5 years, but whatever. But
yeah,
anyways,
yeah.
My story was that the booker asked Pete Lee, who just recently had a special on Showtime, what he thought about my act, and he said nice things, and that helped me. And I didn't know Pete Lee well. I would see him at the Comic Strip when I was doing late night, just being polite, seeing him around. So like, over time, you're just developing all these relationships and these perceptions of you from other people in the industry, or I don't stop saying industry, other comedians, other comics, we're all gonna get each other's backs. Like, if you're funny and nice, like, you never know how things are gonna pan out. You never know.
For sure. And I mean, listen, like, you're a recruiter. Like, you know how this works. People want to work with people that they want to talk to. Like, it's, yep. You spend a lot of time with people at work. Like, what are, like, when anybody in our industry talks about cultural fit, like, what do we think they're talking about? Like, it's not like, do you tick a box? It's like, do I think we're going to be good together? Like, you know, if I'm playing a leadership role, like, are you going to be an individual player that like contributes, or are you going to be a drag on what I'm trying to accomplish? Like, I mean,
nobody wants to work with an asshole. It's not just your act. Like 95% of the time, you're not on stage. 95% of the time, you're talking to other people off stage. That's who you really are. That's a big part of it.
I would agree. I would definitely agree. I mean, I think, you know, I haven't seen you, like, I haven't seen your act in a long time. Like, I always check you out on YouTube or whatever. Like, I've seen your act a bunch of times. Yeah. And, like, I sometimes wonder, like, have you, and this I'd be interested more for friends of yours. I don't know if you do a good job of being able to evaluate this, but, like, how close are you to Danny the person that I know is funny as shit, like, in person versus how does that translate on stage, right? Like, and I think that's hard, right? Like, that's super hard because of the compressed time frame, and you're trying to tell a joke, you're trying to come through, and, you know, if I hang with you for a couple hours, like, I know who you are, so it's a lot different, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate goal, right? Where there's not really, there's no blurred line between who you are off stage and who you are on. It's like, have you seen Funny People? I'm sure you've seen that, right? Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen.
Yeah. No, I actually haven't.
You haven't?
It's a depressing movie, right? Like, there's like a depressing aspect of it.
I'm not into that. No, well, it's not all depressing though. It's pretty good. I would recommend watching it. It wasn't like overly.
No. I know exactly what you're talking about. But like, I'm a hard pass on like terms of endearment, cancer.
Oh, no, it's not.
Like, I'm a hard pass.
Not like that at all. Well, there's a scene. Adam Sandler is dying from cancer, but that's not all focused on. But there's a scene. Adam Sandler's like the tutor or mentor to Seth Rogen, and they're sitting down. I think they're in some like mall food court. And he goes, Adam says to Seth, "The thing I like about your act now is I'm seeing more of you. I see more of you on stage than I see off stage. Like, you off stage, I love, is very funny. I'm seeing more of that on stage." And I was like, that when I heard that, the kind of a light went off. Like, that is the ultimate goal. There shouldn't be a distinction, ideally.
But I think real comics,
there can be, but
real comics know though that, like, I mean, there are some legendary comics that are not real, right? Like, they are just, they're complete ripoffs, right? Like, they just, it is what it is, right? Like, there are legendary comics that, like, famously, like, just steal, right? It's like, so, I mean, I think. Real comics know, like, you know, when you make that kind of translation to like, hey man, Danny finally gets it, or whoever it is, like, insert person's name of like, hey, they finally get it, like, that's the guy like we were hanging out with, like, and I don't know how he's doing it, but like for 15 minutes he's being that same guy, like, that's crazy, right? Like, and I think that, like, your personality, confidence, rhythm, the material, like, it all has to come together, right? Like, that's not an easy thing to just say. Like, I mean, it's easy for me to say, for sure. I'm never going up.
It's massively intimidating.
Yeah.
That Mike Kaplan is a great comic here. He has a quote about, like, people will tell him that he has a very, like, refined and honed voice and, like, persona on stage, and they're like, how did you develop that refined persona and voice? And he goes, I didn't do anything. He goes, all I did was just performed over and over and over. And then at some point people were like, hey, you have a refined persona and voice. He's like, I didn't do a fucking thing except do the task repeatedly.
No, that it definitely
chisels
makes sense.
Out like Michelangelo out of the stone.
And how often do you update your act in terms of, like, do you add to it constantly? Or are you doing the same, like, material over and over? Like, how are you doing? Like, how's kind of your process?
Yeah, I always have at least like 3 to 4 new jokes that I'm working on at any one time that have, you know, like a 25% chance of working. So it's frustrating because it's hard to, any comic will tell you, it's really hard to build new material to be great. And I'm always like walking into a comedy club, looking at my set, being like, Jesus, Danny, 12 years, you have zero jokes, you suck. But it's hard. It's hard to build out new material. But I always have like at least 3 to 4 new jokes that I'm working on at any one time. And I'll try them out a few times. If they seem to have promise, I'll keep working on them. If they have no promise, I'll throw them out. But so I'll do it like a circus tent where, like, the beginning of my set, I'll do like a joke that I know is hopefully will hit two or three of those. then in the middle, work in some newer stuff. I always have newer stuff I'm working on 100% of the time. It'd be boring if I didn't do that. And then at the end, do like, you know, your closer joke. So I always have, I'm always trying to build my new stuff to be as good as my A, which is mandatory because the A over time will fall off because the crowd senses that you're tired of the material or you become a better writer and your voice is better now than it was when you first started that joke. You know, like you can have your best joke in the world start to tank. And you're like, what the fuck? And it's like, no, it's because you're better now. You're a better writer. You're a better performer. You wrote that when you weren't as good, which is interesting.
I gotcha. No. I mean, I'm always fascinated by the comedic process and structure. I guess to me, like everything you really need to know about leadership at the C level, like in our business, like we sometimes talk with folks that are, you know, leading very large, you know, groups of people and have to deliver a message that resonates through electronic media or whatever it is. And I just think, like, you know, I've seen so many leaders like get up and try to deliver like a keynote speech. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people over time. And I just think that like comedians, like to me, like if you give some of them just the right, like structure in terms of content, like they just can kill in any, like, I just think that they could definitely lead people like the horse to water and all that stuff. Like, I just am like, all right, we're going over the cliff. We're like, all right, he says we're going over the cliff. He's super funny. Come on, let's do this.
Right. You think that they could have a chance? They could potentially be better leaders of people than some CEOs you've seen deliver keynote speeches?
For sure.
Well, I guess
sure.
I don't understand.
And I think a lot of it. But... Well, I think I'm part of it is just right. Like, I think comics have been humbled over and over and over again. So like they have experienced failure over and over and over again. And yep. To me, like, right. Like that's all we like, right. I mean, like we all experience a lot of failure in life and how you overcome it is kind of the character that you build. Right. I mean, we're talking about like, right. All the different, what'd you say, David, the whatever, like sculpture that you were talking about.
Oh yeah. Like just, the Michelangelo carving David out of
Michelangelo. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever seen that in person?
No, I've never been to Italy.
Oh my God, that thing is out of control.
Is it amazing?
You basically think that guy's alive.
Jesus, dude.
Like the moment you see it, like it's not like there aren't that many things that have impressed me like over the, and I've been to like some interesting places across the world. Like I've traveled for work and all that stuff. You know that like that we just did, my wife and I, and that whole Florence experience was, I mean, it's enormous. And you're just like, I think that guy's alive. Like that is crazy. And, wow. Yeah, like it's crazy. Like that is honest to goodness. One of the most, like, I am not an art guy. I'm not a guy that like has an appreciation for like the finer things in life. I'm definitely like, but that was one of those breathtaking moments where I was like, oh, I guess I understand.
Wow. I want to go look at it online now. I mean, obviously yeah. It's not the same thing, but where is it?
No. That's,
where is it? Is it? It's in Rome?
No, it's in Florence. Florence.
Oh, Florence?
Yeah. I think there might be two of them, possibly. I know the original is in Florence. I don't know if there is a second one. I'm not that smart.
Same. I've never been to Italy, so Italy. I'm way behind you.
Yeah. Italy was fun. Italy was definitely fun. What's most underwhelming city? Thing? Huh? I'm sorry.
I was going to ask what your favorite city is.
I was going to say it was Florence. I mean, Florence. The food was amazing, and it was, you could walk over there. It's a small town. We went to Rome. Oh. Rome's super cool. Amazing, amazing stuff all over the place. But, you know, I mean, all that stuff, like, we didn't have a ton of money. So, like, I'm just a big believer, like, whether it's, I mean, there are just certain cities, like, it's just, there's no reason to, like, spend too much time there if you don't have money. Like you just can't, like we did Venice, I think in like 48 hours, I was like, this place is awesome. Get me out of here. Like we can't afford anything. Like,
okay.
Yeah. Like it's too expensive, right? The whole place is sinking. Like you're rich if you live there or you're going to die because you're born and raised there, I'm guessing.
Right. But Florence is not as expensive.
It's just a different thing. Like it's a regular city, right? Like, it's a historic city. Like, in Italy, but it's not sinking, right? So, like, you know, hard to explain, whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't have a potential expiration date in the way that
Yeah. How is Paris? How is France, right? Is that what you just mean? Spain, sorry.
Yeah, Barcelona.
Barcelona, right?
Dude, I spent 10 days there. Fucking amazing. Have you been?
No. I've never done that. Tell me, like, what was the highlight, though? Like, what was, like, the part you were like, man, I wish I could just capture this somehow and, like, explain it?
Man, that's a good question. Let me think about it.
Stop telling me that's a good question. Like, that is a stalling
tactic. You're a good interviewer.
In our industry, correct? As a recruiter, like, oh, that's a really good question.
That's
true. I
can't believe
you asked me that. Yeah.
Dude, recruiters are interviewing recruiters is good.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, that's why I wanted to start doing interviews for my podcast instead of just talking shit about space with Zach. Because, like, that's all I've done my whole adult life is interview. So it's fun to talk about personal stuff. My favorite thing about Barcelona, dude, fuck. I mean, I did like four.
Yeah,
I did like four comedy shows and the audiences were fucking amazing. So that was dope. But I would say, you know what? I'll tell you what it was. By a mile, it was Park Güell. So, like, we saw La Sagrada Familia, that Gaudi, his church that is still under construction, and it's slated to be finished in 5 years, which will be the 100th anniversary of his death. It's arguably the most beautiful structure on the planet. Like, that was fucking insane, and that was amazing. But it's a church. It's just a church. Then, somehow, the Park Güell, I know, I was like, I've got to go there, but I didn't go until the last day, and I'm glad I did. Because it's like Barcelona is like on the ocean and then there's a hill that goes up and Park Güell is on the top of this hill. And I thought it was just going to be like these two little cute, like gingerbread house looking things that you see in the brochure. It's an enormous park. You pay like 10 euros or something to get in. I don't know how many acres this park is, but it's enormous and it overlooks the sea. It overlooks the city. The architecture is incredible. It's like, I have this, I went to the gift shop and got these like beautiful coaster. Like it's probably the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And then, like, dude, I literally went back to my hotel room, like, and 2 hours after I had gone there, and I cried from the beauty. That's never happened in my whole life.
No,
it was that
awesome,
beautiful. Man. I didn't know it was going to be like that. I didn't know it was going to be that level of gorgeous.
That's awesome, right? I mean, it's awesome to be able to. But whatever. You did it. Like, that's the most important thing. You did it, and like, you experienced that.
Yeah, exactly. What's been your favorite place to visit on the planet? Florence?
I mean, we had an awesome time there. I'm trying to think of places that I've really enjoyed. Argentina. I was there for a real short business trip. That was ridiculous.
Buenos Aires?
I said to somebody, yeah, Buenos Aires. Yeah. I'll never forget. So first off, everybody eats after 10 o'clock, which I was like, yeah, I'm not down with this. Like, this is not good for me. Like, I need to be asleep. Like, I'm going to be awake at 8 a.m. and it's not going to be good.
Right.
So like at 10 p.m., you're eating with the waiters, basically. Like, they're all coming in, like, right. And so, like, I sit down and it's just me. And I was like, I heard, like, it's legendary steak. Like, so everything is, there's no steroids. It's all grass fed. Like, they're huge. Their cows are just legendary. Like, if you look it up online, like, and everything. And so I was like, I'd like to get a filet. And I wasn't huge steak guy, like, earlier in my life, you know, like, as I got older, I got a little more refined, whatever. Earlier it was just like, oh, it's a filet, it's a steak. Like, I didn't know anything. And I was like, so what size? And she was like, what? I was like, what size? Like, I don't want to get it too big. And she was like, you want the steak, right? And I was like, okay, like, clearly I cannot communicate, right? Like, Spanish, and like, if you do Mexico Spanish versus Argentinian Spanish, it's completely different. Like, sometimes they just don't even understand. And she brought out a steak that was overflowing, bigger than my entire plate. It was the largest thing I've ever seen. And I was like, oh, this is not going to end well for my evening. And I didn't have any of the sides. And I just like ate until I got the meat sweats. And it was awesome. Like, that place was, I mean, that place is just like historic, beautiful, right? Like, just, I think Evita was there, right? Like, if you see that movie, I think that was from there, right?
Yeah.
Madonna. I got to think you're a Madonna guy, right?
I love Madonna.
Of course you do. Of course.
Her birthday's the day before mine. We're simpatico.
Of course, you know that. Come on, dude. My wife loves Madonna, so I mean, we have VHS tapes in the basement.
You took off that your wife goes to bed. All right, sorry, stupid joke. Had to throw it in. What were you gonna say?
No. I want to say it's unfortunate, like what she's doing now in terms of like how she looks.
Your wife? I like your wife. She's nice.
No, my wife's not that old. But Madonna, like I just, but in the same respect, I'm like, I mean, like, why shouldn't she in her 60s, like try to look as young as possible? Like, who cares?
Oh yeah. She had her nipple out on Instagram. And then they made her take it down and censor it. But I saw it when it wasn't censored. I was like, oh, there's Madonna's tits. Nice.
Was that your first time?
Probably. I didn't buy that sex book or whatever it was.
Oh, I had the penthouse, I forgot what the guy's name is. The guy who owned Penthouse paid a ton of money for like the pictures she took in Manhattan, like when she was like 19, 20 years old and all hairy and everything like that. Yeah. And it was a big, like, whatever. Bob Guccione. That's his name. Bob Guccione. He ran Penthouse. Yeah. These are all things that I am not sure I should be saying into a microphone.
Yeah. This conversation just got way more seedy.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back to steak in Argentina.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm just kidding. Well, dude, I feel like we should wrap because I'm a little concerned about the storage capabilities of my computer. That's how.
Oh, sure. Yeah. For sure. No.
But I feel bad because we didn't talk about your life and your background and your family and like. So let's do that the next time you're on.
Yeah. And, if there's a next time, this is a great combo. Definitely talk.
What?
Yeah. I mean, I love talking to you. I think
to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we always have a great conversation. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
That's why I like podcasts.
Yeah. What'd you say?
I was going to say you get somebody smart in a room and sit and stare at them. Joe Rogan's right. You get somebody smart, you stare at them for an hour. Like things you just have a better conversation than in other aspects of life, and you're always distracted by other shit. It's just you can just go to this different mental place. It's calmer and a lot of times it's smarter combo.
Yeah. No, you know? You listen to Rogan a lot?
Yeah, pretty much everyone except for like the WWE shit. I don't care about that. I mean, MMA. Mixed martial arts stuff. I don't really care about that. And sometimes they'll have like meat eaters. I don't really care about that shit either. But sometimes I listen to those. But I'd rather hear him talk to like a philosophy professor about consciousness, like what he had on recently. Like that kind of stuff fascinates me. And then, dude, his interview. I know people are like, oh, Joe Rogan, bro, Rogan, but whatever. His interview with Jewel, dude. Have you heard that?
No. I don't think I have.
The best podcast episode I've listened to in my entire life, and I've listened to a lot. It is insane. Her story is completely fucking insane. Homeless 15-year-old in Alaska, staring at the ocean, thinking about how the tide comes in and the tide comes out, reminded her that the despair and suffering she was currently undergoing won't last forever, inspired her to try to create a better life for herself. Because she looked at the fucking tides when she was a homeless 15-year-old. Like, that girl's a fucking savant. I highly recommend it to anybody, dude. Seriously.
All right.
Very inspiring. She has this foundation to help empower teens with mental skills to make good decisions and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, thanks for doing this pod. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Have a great day.
You too. It's 9:15 at night, but.
Good point. It's a good point.
Thanks for doing the pod, you fucking G. Thanks, Jared. Take care.
Bye-bye.